At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This was a good day for those whose job it is to read the economic tea leaves. Something is brewing out there, and it just might be the labor market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 9th of September today. It has been a while since we hauled this one out, but today's economic news comes with the welcome preface of better than expected. And it comes in two flavors, too. The trade deficit was down in July. We're selling more stuff overseas than we have been. Back home, new claims for unemployment benefits fell last week as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports the job market does appear to be emerging from hibernation ever so slowly.
The average number of new unemployment claims has actually been on the decline ever since mid-August, when it peaked. So it's probably a good bet the labor market really is on the mend, says Nigel Galt at IHS Global Insight.
It looks as though claims that hit 500,000 a few weeks ago are now gradually on their way down.
But here's the thing. Galt says economists want to see claims fall much more before they declare this a strong jobs recovery. Instead, 1 year after the economy started growing again, unemployment remains high, and companies are adding jobs very slowly, less than 100,000 a month. But at least that's better than we did after the recession of 2001.
It took almost 2 years for the economy to actually start to create jobs again.
After the 1990s recession, the jobless recovery was just about as bad. But there is a big difference, says economist James Galbraith at the University of Texas.
In this Great Recession, we lost over 8 million jobs, more than twice what we lost in the previous two recessions. And so this is just a much deeper hole, and that's the problem.
A problem, says Galbraith, because job growth would need to be phenomenal, double or triple the current rate for years, just to backfill the hole. And he's not optimistic employers will step up.
A great many firms cut their costs and their labor forces really drastically. Having done that, they're very reluctant to take workers back. In fact, they find ways to achieve the same results with fewer workers.
And as long as companies keep chasing increased productivity so hard, it's unlikely they'll add enough jobs to take a big bite out of unemployment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Apple rocked an important part of the technology world today. That's the part that makes software applications for mobile devices. Apple eased off on some of the rules for developers, the folks who make the apps for the iPhone and the iPad. There are something like 250,000 apps available out there, everything from one that turns your iPhone into a flashlight to one that lets you listen to public radio. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains why Apple changed its mind.
Apple's business model is based on a pretty closed system. The company controls its devices and what software can run on them. Apple delivered that same message of control to developers making apps for the iPad and iPhone.
Developers, if you want to write applications for this, you have to do it according to our rules.
That's David Berland, editor-in-chief at TechWeb.com. He says Apple restricted developers from using certain development tools, like Adobe's Flash software. But today, Apple relaxed the restrictions. The company says it listened to developers and took their feedback to heart. Berlin says Apple changed its rules to keep up with the competition, namely Google's Android mobile operating system.
Google's cutting into Apple's market share. So Apple is really under the gun to make sure that as many developers can come to their platform and build applications in the language of their choice.
There may be one more reason Apple relaxed its rules. To fend off any allegations of anti-competitive practices from Adobe, Larry Dignan's editor-in-chief of ZDNet.
Adobe brought a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission. And, you know, we've seen this before where regulators start to poke around and, you know, suddenly things get fixed.
Whatever the reason, software developers are thrilled. Rob Terrell's with TouchCentric. The company's made more than 50 mobile apps.
I think it removes the cloud that had been hanging over us. So now developers can use whatever the best tool for the job is.
That freedom should translate into more interesting games and apps for all of us. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today? Yeah, there's an app for that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was an honest-to-gosh raid on a pirate ship off the coast of Somalia today. 24 American Marines took back a German-owned ship. It had been commandeered by pirates earlier this week, a small blow against increasingly common disruptions of international trade. A lot of the business of actually grappling with piracy, though, happens not off the coast of Africa, but in London, as Christopher Worth reports.
Standing in front of a giant map of the Gulf of Aden, Tim Hart looks something like a weather forecaster.
If we look at the Somali coast, yes, you had a few isolated attacks up here, but very little.
He points to dozens of different colored dots that mark pirate hotspots around Somalia.
We say, red is a successful hijacking, orange is an attempted attack, and yellow will have a suspicious vessel.
Hart is with the maritime security firm MUSC. Over the past couple of years, it's begun working with shipping companies to track their vessels through areas where Somali pirates operate. From London, Hart and his team can be in constant contact with the ship's captain, keeping an eye on where the latest attacks are happening.
The piracy industry within Somalia itself is a huge industry now, and it is obviously a major concern to a lot of shipping companies.
While that pirate industry has grown, another lucrative industry has sprung up in London to deal with it. That includes security to repel pirates if they strike, and the payment of ransoms if the pirates succeed. Stephen Askins is a maritime lawyer with INSEECO. He says once a ship is hijacked, its owners rely on a whole host of attorneys and negotiators to get it and the crew released, and the bills can add up quickly.
A $4 million ransom may actually be a $15 to $20 million problem.
Askins says it's no accident that much of that work takes place in London. Though tour boats make up the bulk of traffic on the River Thames today, for centuries it was cargo ships that dominated the waters around the British capital. As a result, many ship owners still operate here, and they're insured through the London insurance market. Richard Skirl is with Special Contingency Risks, which specializes in piracy insurance. He says where traditionally shipping companies didn't buy kidnap and ransom coverage, today demand is booming.
I would estimate the piracy insurance to be worth approximately $100 million to the insurance market, and that's just new premium to the market within the last 2 years.
None of the insurers Marketplace contacted agreed to comment, nor did any shipping companies. As with the pirates themselves, a veil of secrecy covers much of the industry set up to deal with piracy. That may be because it's come under increasing pressure to stop paying ransoms, which many say only perpetuates the problem. And recent media reports have suggested that London industry may have a vested interest in seeing those payments continue. Stephen Askins disagrees.
Yes, it's expensive. Yes, clearly people make money out of dealing with these things, but I don't think that any of us, though, are seeking to exploit the situation.
The Obama administration is pushing for measures in the United Nations that would make it harder to pay ransoms. It's concerned that money is ending up with terrorist groups in Somalia. But Askins says with hundreds of seafarers currently held captive at any one time, that could put those lives at risk.
The genie has long since left the bottle. Ransoms have to be paid.
Paying a ransom is legal in the UK, another reason many are negotiated here. And the UK's shipping industry is lobbying to keep it that way. The British government has placed an indefinite hold on the measures in the UN. In an emailed statement, the UK's Foreign Office said it was taking time to review the legal implications of those measures. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
With Monday being Labor Day and today Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, this is something of a short trading week. You'd never know it, though, to look at one particular corner of the capital markets. Corporate debt has been on fire. From blue chips like Hewlett-Packard to firms with junk ratings, companies have issued $32 billion worth of bonds this week. That is the most of any week this year, short or otherwise. It's because interest rates are so low and investors are desperate for returns that are better than bank deposits and seemingly safer than stocks. But Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains the frothy bond market is not without its risks.
It's cheap money for corporations to build their businesses or simply build up their cash on hand. Investors see it as a way to shield themselves from the threat of a deflationary spiral and get some kind of return for their money without climbing on the Wall Street roller coaster. James Floyd is senior research analyst at Minnesota's Luthold Group. He also works with investors as a fund manager.
They're looking for safety. They're tired of losing money. We've lost money in our house. We've lost money in our 401k, and I think they're just trying to stop the pain by investing in an asset class that can't go down. At least that's what they're hoping.
Still, investors big and small have been willing to shovel their cash over even to corporations with the weakest credit ratings. Just last month, nearly $25 billion in junk bonds were sold. Investors get no guarantee they'll be paid back. The demand has pushed bond interest rates lower since companies can attract buyers without raising rates. IBM recently raised $1.5 billion in fresh capital by offering a return of just 1%. At Envision Capital Management, investment strategist Marilyn Cohen sees irony in the voracious appetite for the smallest of returns.
What's the big deal? There is no big deal. In fact, it's a little deal. It's a little rate of return for a much more downside than upside potential.
Luthold Group's James Floyd says as long as banks stay reluctant to lend and keep paying even smaller returns, the corporate bond market will remain attractive for investors.
Short-term interest rates could stay low for quite some time as the U.S. economy struggles. So I don't see there's any light at the end of the tunnel for that changing, maybe for a few years.
But Envision Capital's Marilyn Cohen fears a bubble that can't keep growing forever.
I think the proverb here is wherever the massive amounts of money are going will be the next area of great pain and anguish.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The basic concept behind a bond is pretty simple. You borrow money, you pay it back with interest, even with more than 80 years of interest. Some American investors have taken Germany to court over some really old German government bonds. From the Marketplace European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
The bonds have a rocky past, issued by the so-called Weimar Republic in the 1920s, cancelled by Hitler. They became apparently worthless, consigned to the dustbin of history, but not according to Miami-based attorney Sam Dubin.
Any government, German or any other government, needs to understand that if it's going to borrow from people who put up money in good faith, the government will be held responsible for what it promised to do.
Dubin's client is an American company that's bought hundreds of these Weimar bonds with a face value of millions of dollars. The company wants that cash, and that's why it's suing the German government.
People who invest in government bonds deserve to be paid back, and that's what this litigation is intending to vindicate.
The German government, however, says the claim is baseless.
They were paid already, and the bonds have no value anymore.
Ingrid Jaeger is with the Federal Office for Unresolved Property Issues in Berlin. She says Germany repaid most of the bonds back in the 1950s, including all those that are now held by American litigants.
There was a deadline in 1958, and all these bonds were paid.
You're going to fight this case then? You're not going to pay up?
No, we won't.
It's a complicated case involving Russian soldiers and stolen bond certificates. The German government has support from a surprising quarter.
Sometimes people have to accept that the past has happened and it's best just to leave it alone.
That, believe it or not, is an economic historian, Tim Leunig of the London School of Economics. He says raking over ancient property rights is pointless.
Certainly when it's some really dramatic event like the Great Depression, Hitler, the Second World War, and then the post-war German settlement. That's enough history to accept that the past is the past.
He says the American litigants are just out for a quick buck and have no moral claim against today's government in Berlin. But a court in Miami disagrees. It's ruled that Germany does have a case to answer. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, in the places that are worst off in this recession, it's never just black and white.
This idea of just put some more money out there, big grants, and everybody will be lifted up is not going to be the case.
But first, let's do the numbers. Better than expected, nudge the markets up today. The Dow Industrials gained 28 points, about a quarter of 1%, closed at 10,415. The NASDAQ up 7 points, a third of 1%, ended at 2236. The S&P 500 climbed 5 points, 0.4%, finished at 1104. Financial stocks strengthened after Morgan Stanley said it thinks banks will be able to buy back shares and boost their dividends this year. JP Morgan Chase rose 2.5%, Bank of America added 1%, but Deutsche Bank slipped more than 3% today on reports that Germany's biggest bank has asked some investment banks if they'd help manage a stock sale of up to 9 billion euros. That's selling Deutsche Bank stock. Look out for that one. McDonald's bit off 2.25% today. It looks like August sales in Europe were a little more lukewarm than expected. Men's Warehouse pulled up its pants nearly 6%. Second quarter profits beat analyst estimates there. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield thus rose to 2.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for the month of July. At the White House, President Obama holds a press conference. Remarks on the economy are anticipated. And it's billed as America's most exciting medical marijuana event of the year. HempCon gets rolling tomorrow in Los Angeles. Among the free educational seminars, how to start a cannabis business. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The White House is studiously not calling its latest economic package a new stimulus plan. Might be just as well, because getting money from earlier federal programs out into the economy has run into a bottleneck. There aren't enough federal workers to award and manage all those government contracts. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The problem, says Allison Stanger, the author of One Nation Under Contract, is the number of federal employees today is the same as it was in 1963.
Yet the federal budget in real terms in that same period of time has more than tripled, and that enormous gap is filled by contractors.
The government was short of people to oversee contracts from nuclear waste disposal to the space program even before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which rely heavily on contractors. Now add another $275 billion in stimulus contracts, and monitoring all of them for waste and fraud is almost impossible, says Don Kettle, dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland.
We've so vastly increased the amount of spending in such a short time, government employees are really struggling to keep up with the oversight burdens that have come along with the recovery program.
In some cases, government agencies have had to contract out oversight of their own contracts.
Matter of fact, we've experienced that here in DHS.
Richard Skinner, the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security, says that's fraught with potential conflicts of interest.
These contractors may not have the government's best interest in play here. I do not believe it's healthy to have contractors managing other contractors.
Skinner says the government needs more skilled managers. And in fact, President Obama wants to boost the government's contract workforce by 5%. Author Allison Stanger has another suggestion.
My solution is what I call radical transparency.
She means let the public track all government contracts right on the internet. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
That number we started with today, the better-than-expected report on unemployment claims, is a welcome sign of life in an otherwise stuck labor market. The unemployment rate is stubbornly high, 9.6% last month. For African Americans, though, it's even worse, more than 16%, 16.3 to be precise. What that figure means in actual practice becomes much more clear when you get to cities with large black populations. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson spent 2 weeks traveling all across Tennessee exploring how the recession and recovery are being felt in the heartland. He filed this report on jobs from Memphis.
It's a hot afternoon in Millington, Tennessee, a suburb just north of Memphis. About a dozen people are sitting around a table listening carefully to instructions. They've finally found work helping flood victims for $9 to $15 an hour.
Again, these are temporary jobs right now. They're to last 4 weeks. And again,
the faces around the table tell the story. The struggle of the Great Recession will continue, but these jobs are 4 weeks of relief. More relief for some than for others. Here's a 59-year-old African-American man named Edward Broadway, who's been laid off for more than a year.
I don't see it getting better because we've been out of job for going on from April the 4th of 09 to now. You know, you go up to a job, trying to ask for a job, you know, people tell you they ain't hiring, nothing like that, you know, so it ain't got no better because it's right now, and more people are getting laid off still, you know, because closing places down and stuff like that.
Sitting across the table from Edward Broadway is a white woman named Katie Spence. She's been out of work for months, too, but here's how she describes her situation.
It's a little bit of a struggle. We've had to cut back on luxuries, but as far as the actual struggle, I've been one of the lucky ones. My husband, he's been really supportive of me as far as everything. We just bought a new car last year, so we're having to make payments on that and everything. We also have a baby and one on the way, and it's a lot all at once, but we're making it through.
Those two accounts sound different because here in Memphis, there are two recessions going on, one for blacks, who make up more than 60% of the population, and one for whites. University of Memphis sociologist Phyllis Betts says in this city, low-wage workers are black workers, and they're less prepared for a lengthy economic downturn.
Certainly, we've got a lot of high-wage managerial and technical positions that have been downsized. But in those particular cases, better off families, more likely to have savings. When you're talking about low-wage workers without much of a cushion, they're going to feel the recession in a different way.
To get a bird's-eye view of the unemployment picture here, I went to City Hall. Mayor A.C. Wharton peers out the windows of his seventh-floor office at the Mississippi River that built this town. 25 years after International Harvester and Firestone closed Memphis operations and laid off thousands, the job situation hasn't gotten much better. And Mayor Wharton says the problems run deepest for his African-American constituents, the vast majority of which live in low-income households or outright poverty.
The greater number of high school dropouts in the black community, the greater number of unwed teen mothers, the greater number of AIDS cases, the greater number of folks behind bars, right in this immediate area, with all of our jails and prisons, we have around 11 to 12,000 people behind bars. Stop to think about that. And probably 95% are African American.
He says that high incarceration rate means many looking for jobs don't bother applying because of their criminal history.
We could come in here and I could say tomorrow I've got 2,000 jobs, open the door. A lot of people wouldn't show up because they know, first of all, that they've got a criminal record, and at the bottom of the application it's going to ask, have you ever been convicted of a felony? They've been rejected so many times, why torture themselves by coming up applying? There's going to be others who say, well, there's no need for me to go there. I don't have transportation. I can't get there.
So once these jobs end, you'll be able to access their resources and hopefully find long-term, more permanent employment. Okay, so we want.
Back at the job orientation in Millington, James Granberry proves the mayor's point.
When was the last job that you had?
2007. I used to work driving backhoes, doing landscape, different things like that.
How has he been managing for the last 3 years, paying the bills?
Well, my wife was working at the motel when my mother-in-law got sick. My mother-in-law drew a little money. That's how we was managing, you know, like that.
In other words, Social Security checks and unemployment checks are what the Granberry family has been living on. Those lucky enough to find work here may take a part-time job at FedEx, the city's largest employer. Others take public sector jobs, which have filled the gap since major employers skipped town. That means when there's a recession and tax receipts fall, there can be a spiraling effect on the local economy. And when there's a national boom, it's barely felt here. The black middle class has been fleeing to the suburbs, and Mayor Wharton says for the city's black poor, a rising tide doesn't seem to lift all boats.
Some of them, even if you give them the boat, they don't know how to paddle. Others will punch holes in it. So this idea of just put some more money out there, big grants, and everybody will be lifted up is not going to be the case.
The mayor pauses, takes a deep breath, and looks me right in the eye. He tells me that dealing with this disparity seems overwhelming, but it can be done. In Memphis, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
While he was out on the road for us, Jeremy asked everybody he met whether they are feeling any recovery. You can hear their stories and share your own about the recession and the recovery on our website. It's marketplace.org. The next installment of Jeremy's series from Tennessee tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, more evidence, if somehow you needed it, that Donald J. Trump will do just about anything for publicity. Trump waded into the flap over the proposed mosque and Islamic Center a couple of blocks from Ground Zero today. Trump has offered to buy out one of the mosque's key backers for 25% more than what the guy paid for it. To be fair, Trump did say in a statement from his publicist, by the way, that he is doing it to end what he calls a highly divisive situation. And on that note, this Thursday, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 28 points, about a quarter of 1%. The Nasdaq put on 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 0.4%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news and more from Jeremy Hobson in Tennessee. Coming up next time on this program, when freedom doesn't really mean free.
They are certainly free relatively economically, and they have some free time, and yet they can't find a way to make themselves happy.
Jonathan Franzen talks about his new book, Freedom. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.